bring our minds to rest for a moment, to check in with our posture, just be in an alert and relaxed state and ready to focus on the meaning of the prayers that we're going to chant, to set our intentions and gather some merit and empower our practice and study today. And I will mute everybody so that we can start the chant. Okay. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Dadan sam shantam chelo chasudro arzinji lapti sol chalam didro arzinji lapti sol am chulpa sel arzinji lapti sol chulpa yeshi suchar arzinji lapti sol. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dang nu chen ke chubum da da mi ke nam dang dro a kun ji dra ke ji tsam bar tam ji ke du da ki cha ten to. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And my window slightly open, but now it's chilly. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never lose touch with true happiness, which harbors no suffering. May they come to rest in vast, impartial equanimity, free from attachment and aversion. Okay, so today we're going to do a very short meditation at the beginning because we're going to use Ken MacLeod's commentary as a meditation today. It's a fabulous meditation, very excellent way to present the subject matter of verse 22. So what we will start out with a little bit of meditation, both ultimate and relative bodhicitta, our usual sequence. So again, just bringing our minds to rest, our body into a straight, stable, relaxed, grounded posture, really feeling our grounding with our feet on our seat, with our squared shoulders, our upright posture, and making sure we're relaxed. Bringing our attention down from our thoughts, all the things we had to do to get here today, and just letting it come to rest in our body, feeling what our body feels like in this present moment of existence. Taking a moment to bring to mind each of the four reminders, the precious human existence, impermanence and death, karma, cause and result, and the suffering of samsara, and motivations for practicing now and practicing diligently, not wasting our opportunity. And then we do a brief guru yoga by bringing our lama or the Buddha to mind on a lotus and moon seat above our head in a body of light, radiating awakening, radiating love and compassion, smiling, very happy that we're doing this practice. And we internally to ourselves request the blessings of the Lama, of the Buddha, to empower our practice, to help us attain the same level of awakening, of love and compassion, of bodhicitta as they have achieved. And if it's the Lama, it can be the Lama in the form of Dorje Chang, or it can be a specific Lama. And then we feel that we have received the blessing because they always give us the blessing. And what we're doing now is simply opening ourselves to receive it in this moment. And we let the visualization descend through the crown of our head and come to rest in our heart center, where we feel the Lama's presence, the Buddha's presence, still radiating, awakening, love, compassion, bodhicitta. And then within that state, we let our minds come to rest by following our breath for a few rounds. Not breathing any particular way, but just letting ourselves breathe naturally and be aware with a small percentage of our attention of the inhalation and the exhalation and any pauses in between. Meanwhile, the rest of our attention is completely open, touching the base with the vast, empty, limitless nature of our mind. Using the breath as a focus to bring our minds to rest and free our minds from distraction. And now letting go of following the breath, we flash openness. So just momentarily become aware of our Buddha nature, the nature of mind, this vast, limitless emptiness and awareness unified. And we rest in that for a moment, and that's ultimate bodhicitta, the nature of mind. And now we imagine, or we bring to mind that space, that vast emptiness, is actually filled with sentient beings, packed in like sardines, as far as the mind can reach, and all of them are suffering. Remaining aware of the vastness of the number of sentient beings and their many forms, their many realms, some of them visible, some invisible. And if any specific beings come to mind, we can include them particularly. And we begin taking and sending. We'll just do a few rounds, breathing in whatever suffering these beings have, any of them or all of them. Breathing it in as a dark, heavy, hot light. letting it dissolve with our breath into our Buddha nature, and breathing out whatever we need, relief, healing, happiness, peace, and so forth. Making it as vivid as possible, this awareness of all sentient beings and their suffering and of any specific beings we wish to include. Really breathing in their suffering and taking it away from them, letting it dissolve and breathing out happiness and peace and relaxation and relief that fills them completely. We can include ourselves if we need to. Not losing touch with the vastness of our scope, of our awareness, of our mind. And we think that we and all sentient beings, including any specific ones, and including all beings of all realms, are now completely free of suffering, completely filled with happiness and peace, and completely awakened, and we rejoice in this. And now we let go of all of the visualization and all thoughts, and we just come back to that state of flashing openness, of resting in awareness, the union of emptiness and luminosity, or awareness. In which all appearances arise without ceasing and without limit. And we come back now to class at our own pace. You can stretch if you need to, have a sip of something. So now we will do the verses. So I'll do the screen share. And welcome to Angela, Anne, and Dan. You made it. Glad to see that you made it so soon. So we'll do all of the verses today, and we're going to chant the first verse three times. That's the verse we're going to review today. I don't know if everybody read my email, but from now, probably till the end of class, we will pick a verse, probably in order, but maybe some exceptions, to review for about 5 minutes in the class to refresh our memory of it. So today we're reviewing verse one. We'll chant it three times and then everything else once until we get to our verse for the day. So first, the preliminary practices. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives, on solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness a guest will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane. Constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect? Themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail, the three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Now the three levels of motivation for Dharma practice. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts just for that, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning, cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Now, stepping onto the path of action bodhicitta, this is the cultivation of love and compassion. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now the bodhisattva boot camp. Actual practice of taking and sending in daily life. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times, my wealth, my wealth, good deeds, and merit everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds, This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults and speaks of me with undisguised contempt, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow sincerely with respect to them, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone my inferior or peer through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher and place them reverently on my crown, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I've lost everything and everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt, I'm stricken by disease and very sick, on top of that a demon's in my head, to take on all the suffering of beings completely free of all discouragement, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've achieved the pinnacle of fame and the whole world bows down to me in awe, I'm rich beyond my very wildest dreams. Whatever money buys, I have it all, to see that there's no essence in success and never think I'm better than the rest. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So now we're in the three poisons, also really a bodhisattva boot camp, but these are the three poisons and how to purify them or clear them away. If I don't tame my inner enemy, the poison of aggression, anger, hate, then outer enemies just multiply, no matter how to vanquish them I fight, to tame my own mind with an army of the forces of compassion, kindness, love. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Sense pleasures and desire are like salt water. The more I drink them in, the more I crave. Therefore, the moment that attachment stirs, to drop it right away without a pause, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now, so the verse 22, we'll talk about this in a moment too, but verse 22 represents the transition to ultimate bodhicitta. We've been doing relative bodhicitta up to now, and this represents the transition to ultimate bodhicitta, emptiness, the nature of mind, and it also serves as the third of the three poisons, and it is the root poison which gives rise to all the other poisons. To remain free from subject object fixation, we'll do this one three times. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So this is a very important and pithy verse, and I think we're going to spend 2 weeks on it because there's a lot of really wonderful commentary and because this is it. If you get this, you got it. All of relative bodhicitta is leading up to this, and this includes relative bodhicitta in it, but you don't get it without taking the extra step. This is the nature of mind. This is vipassana, insight meditation. And as I said, we're going to use Ken's entire commentary. His commentary is so perfect this week. Last week, I didn't like it so much. This week, I think it's perfect. That's samsara, and that's my own mind making those judgments. But it's a meditation, and we're going to do it because it's so helpful, and you could use it
on a daily basis. It really points you in the right direction to look at all of your experience. And I'm going to go back to screen share just for a second. Right. So here, in keeping with most of the other commentaries, the first line says, all appearances are my own mind. And we understand what's meant by appearances. Ken McLeod says it a little bit differently. He takes a little bit of a liberty from literal translation. He says, whatever arises in experience is my own mind. He says, your own mind. So that's what it means. Everything that we experience, like outer things like clocks and cups of tea and Kindles and notepads, you know, horizons and mountains and cars and elephants and horses, all of those things fall into appearances. And there's the outer ones and then there's the inner ones, which are our own thoughts. And what we're going to learn in this verse is how we filter our perception. You know, all of our sense perceptions are filtered through our own thoughts, our conceptuality, our opinions and judgments and likes and dislikes. And that actually influences how we see things. And that's what we want to learn to see through, to recognize that for what it is, and to free ourselves to really look at things the way that they are. So we're gonna look at some commentaries. Oh, let's get rid of the screen share, sorry. So anybody have anything that they want to say or ask before we delve into commentaries? Okay, and as you know, you can get my attention or unmute yourself anytime if you want to jump in. We're going to look at a little bit of Dingo Chense Rinpoche because he introduces it really well. His commentary is worth reading in its entirety, and what we're going to do is put off the rest of his commentary until next week. Read the whole thing or a lot of it, and I'm going to ask you to please read it at least once, one more time. Two or three more times would be really good. This is it. This is the key. Like, this is everything you need to know. You know, it's like the saying in Buddhism, if you know one thing, then you know it all. You understand one thing, you realize one thing, you realize all things. Well, this is the thing we need to realize. And Dingo Chense Rinpoche presents it in a really understandable, accessible way that is not diluted. You know, it is the thing that we need to know, which is the nature of our own mind, the nature of our experience, how all of that works. So, but we're going to read his introduction, a little bit of his introduction first, and then we're going to look at Pema Chödrön's commentary on this, which is very nice. And then we're going to do Ken McLeod's meditation, and hopefully we'll have a few minutes left at the end to do some Akshobhya mantras, because it turns out they ended up doing 2 weeks of Akshobhya. So their last day of Akshobhya is actually next Sunday, so we may have time to do some Akshobhya mantras today. And the next week, you will continue to study this material, I hope, in between classes. And we will come back to Dingo Chense's Rinpoche with a very, you know, with a background established, because we will have spent some extra time on it. So we're on page 137 of Dingo Chense's commentary, The Heart of Compassion. And right off the bat, like there's a structural thing that's interesting here. And that is that verse 22, so verses 22, 23, and 24 are all about ultimate bodhicitta, or absolute bodhicitta, or the nature of mind. And we're going to see a pattern that we saw before with relative bodhicitta, that the first verse, verse 22, is the actual meditation. This is how you meditate on ultimate bodhicitta, or nature of mind. And the other two verses are how we apply it to our experiences in daily life, which we learn in verse 1 are also our mind. We saw that with the relative bodhicitta. Verse 11 is the taking and sending verse that begins the relative bodhicitta section. And that's the meditation. That's what we do on the cushion. And then all of the other verses of the relative bodhicitta section, all of Bodhisattva boot camp, are how we apply what we get from that meditation to our daily life. It's called post-meditation, whenever we're not actually sitting on our cushion or chair. So we have a similar structure here, and it's really good to be aware of that, that when we are studying verse 22, this is how we meditate. We sit on our chair, we sit on our cushion for a little while every day, and this is what we do. This is what we practice. So I'm just selecting a couple of pithy sections from the first couple of pages of his commentary. He begins by saying, is that the beginning? Yes. The many different perceptions of everything around you in this life arise in your mind. So that's what Kin said. Whatever arises in your experience is your mind. Dingo Chenzi says, the many different perceptions of everything around you in this life arise in your mind. So what does that mean? He says, look at, so he's going to give us a few examples, and Pema Chodron's going to do the same, and Ken McLeod is going to do the same. He says, look at your relationships with others, for example. You perceive some people in a positive way, friends, relatives, benefactors, protectors, while there are others whom you perceive as enemies. So let's think about that. Can you bring anybody to mind that you have a warm feeling towards, and somebody to mind that not so warm? So is this true for us, first of all? That's what we're always asking as we study the Dharma. Does this apply to me? Is this true for me? And if it is, we go on. And if it isn't, we got to think about it. So he says, the ones we perceive as enemies might be those who criticize and defame you, beat, fool, or swindle you. The process starts with the senses, through which the mind perceives various forms, what we see, sounds, smells, tastes, and feelings. So the sensory perceptions come in, whatever that means to come in, but we perceive things through our senses. And as it becomes aware of those objects outside the mind, it categorizes them. So this happens right off the bat. It's not like we see things in a pure way and then we process them. It's like we've already processed them, like within like a most infinitesimal split second of it. We never see things in a pure and direct way. And that is confusion. That's what Gampopa calls confusion or delusion. That's the problem. That's what makes us suffer. So as it becomes aware, as the mind becomes aware of those objects outside, it categorizes them. Those that it finds pleasant, it is attracted to, while those that it finds unpleasant, it tries to avoid. The smell of a rose versus the smell of garbage. The mind that then suffers from not getting the pleasant things it wants and from having to experience the unpleasant things that it wants to avoid. It is always busy running after some pleasant situation or other that it really wants to enjoy. Let's think about it. Does that apply to our life? What are we going to do when we get out from this class? What are we going to try our best to engage in or get? And what are we going to try our best to avoid? But these experiences of things as pleasant or unpleasant are not functions intrinsically belonging to the objects you perceive. They arise only in the mind. So that's what it means. You could study that paragraph for a long time. I would suggest reading that paragraph 7 times between now and the next class. Seriously, every time you read it, it goes in deeper. You see something you didn't see before. And then you can really put it to use. So we're going to skip a paragraph. And he says, generally, mind is the slave of its own biased perceptions, dividing everything into pleasant or unpleasant. And this is the skandhas, remember. The first skanda is we see a form, we have a sense perception, you know, visual or auditory or tactile or whatever. And then next thing comes up is what's called feeling, skanda 2. It's pleasant or it's unpleasant, or it could be neutral. There is a third category. That's instantaneous. And that leads to the third skanda where we start to get into trouble by labeling it and starting to figure out how to deal with it. So dividing in everything into pleasant or unpleasant, the mind constantly tries to experience what is pleasant and to get rid of what is not, blind to the fact that this is not the way to achieve happiness and avoid suffering. Blind ignorance drives the mind constantly to generate feelings of like and dislike. So it comes from ignorance. It comes from ego clinging. It comes from not seeing things the way they are, which is like unbiased, untainted. Blind ignorance. That's what this verse is about. And this verse defines what ignorance is. That's what drives the mind constantly to generate feelings of like and dislike. You engage in endless ordinary worldly activities with no more durability than drawings on water. Preoccupied entirely by these distractions, you exhaust your life and squander this precious human existence with all the freedoms and advantages that you now enjoy. So, he says the mind, so this is the key sentence. The mind thus contrives everything. We're always trying to manipulate our outer circumstances so that we're always in a state of happiness and pleasure and comfort and never in a state of discomfort of any kind. The mind thus contrives everything. So the only thing to do if we really want to be happy, as Dingo Chenzi says is our actual goal, the only thing to do is to master the mind. We can't master outer circumstances. And by master, we might substitute the word control. We can't control what happens to us. We can't control whether it's raining. We can't control anything. We can't control who crosses our path or who's on the other end of the phone. We can avoid, but we can't control it. All we can control is our own mind. And that's what this verse is about, is how to do that. So that's all we're going to read of Dingo Chense today. And we will look at some more of what he says, like how he unfolds this and the examples he uses, which, by the way, for the KDC people, are really similar to how Gampopa presents it and Rinyutulpa presents it in various places, but especially in the Wisdom Paramita, which is what we're on now. So anybody have anything before we look at Pema Chodron, who's going to say pretty much the same thing, but in a really nice way? Not that Dingo Chense's wasn't nice, you know what I mean. All right, Deidre.
What's interesting about this is it's not just something now that is Buddhist, but it's also in the science. Because my husband, who's not a Buddhist, studies the brain science and the books that are written on this, and they basically say the same exact thing.
Wow.
So it's pretty amazing because, you know, before where you could only dialogue something like this with a fellow Buddhist, mm-hmm. Is now joined with the science world. So interesting.
Fascinating. I'm not that familiar with it. That is what Minja Rinpoche wrote his first book about, though, The Joy of Living. If anybody has not read The Joy of Living, that's what it's about. It's about how Buddhism and neuroscience are saying the same thing, basically. Mm-hmm. Not in the kind of depth that Deidre's husband probably understands it, but, you know, just a general presentation. It's really helpful. Anything else, Deidre?
No, I just wanted to share that, you know, it's happening. What Buddha saw thousands of years ago, they're now figuring out in science.
Maybe this means I can have a conversation with my brother, the scientist, again.
Yes, I think you could, because, you know, they both go on the same idea that your free will is no longer quite so free as you think it is.
Okay, well, thank you for bringing that in. Anybody else have anything that they would like to say? Yes, Marilyn, you are unmuted.
Well, if we're going into other disciplines, anthropology first in the 50s, and then all sorts of other traditions in the humanities came up with the idea that there is no such thing as an impartial observer, and that all the scholars who were saying they're presenting an impartial view of the past, whatever their chunk of the past is, or whatever culture they're examining, that's not true. And that was a great advance to allow us to take that, factor that in.
And that was as far back as the 50s.
Yeah. French structuralism came up with it, but that's really obscure. So yeah.
French structuralism?
Yeah. Pretty obscure.
Yeah. I don't know, obscure to some people, maybe not obscure to others. You obviously are familiar with it. All right, anybody have anything else? So it's very interesting. Very interesting that across the disciplines we're seeing that the Buddha really did know something. It's not just like some, you know, religion thing. That's the dismissal is it's just, you know, religion. It's just meant to sort of soften, you know, the fact that we can't deal with things the way they are. But it turns out to be the way things are. Okay, so we're going to look at Pema Chodron now. Again, this is from notes that I took in her seminar on the 37 practices back in 2016 at Omega Institute. So verse 22, she said, and she's using Ken MacLeod's commentary as the basis of her commentary. She says in the second line, mind itself, oh, the second line, so the first line is all appearances are my own mind. And then the second is mind's nature is, mind's nature. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. And I want to talk about that. She's going to talk about that too, but that's something that I did want to point out. That so in the first line, all appearances are my own mind. We're sort of in the ordinary world, like just things are happening around us. We're seeing, you know, various things, cars going by and hearing sounds and so forth. And it's being pointed out that that's all our mind. And we're going to get a lot of help from Ken MacLeod on how to work with that, how to sort of bring that into our experience. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. So all appearances are our mind, but what is mind? And mind here, we're not talking about the samsaric mind, the mind that's always lost in concepts and making judgments and liking and disliking and pleasant and unpleasant. We're talking about the actual underlying nature of mind, like what it really is without all of those overlays. And it's concept free. And it's concept free from the start. And from the start here is the words dune in Tibetan. It's the word that's translated as primordially or sometimes originally meaning, because there's really no start, right? Like if you start looking into that, there's no start. If you ask when mind began, it's like beginningless time is the Buddha's answer. But when we say from the start, we say primordially, which means the same thing. It means that there's never, mind itself is not corrupted or tainted by any concepts that are part of mind itself. Mind itself is completely free of any concept, anything you could say about it. So in the second line, says Pema Chidren, mind itself, or nature of mind's nature, refers to a different aspect than mind in the first line. This is very, very interesting. This is saying that whatever arises, how we experience it is a result of the stories we tell ourselves about it. It depends on the labels we give things. So how we perceive it, how we experience it, feels like that's what's happening. But there's this really instantaneous process that's happening that's coloring all of our experience. So it depends on the stories we tell, depends on the labels we give it. As we label it, so it appears to be for us. Examples usually given are, we usually label or name something as being pleasant or unpleasant. Like that's the first level. How we conceptualize it, how we think about it. Our experience, that's just like a note that I'm not sure what that sentence is supposed to be. Our experience is completely colored by our thinking mind, our conceptualizing, concretizing mind that fixates and makes things solid, or as it says in the verse itself, grasping at signs of subject and object. Like it's that separation. Basically, what we're talking about as the true nature of mind is a non-dual perception. You're not seeing things as separate somehow from yourself. There's no truly existing self that's separate from some truly existing other. But that's the first skanda, is seeing things in that way. You're already in basic ignorance when you perceive things that way, and everything else follows from that. You can't stop it. So in verse 22, we're stopping it right at the source. Like, don't see things that way. Like, you catch yourself in a concept, which just means seeing us, you're the subject and the other thing is the object. Wrong. You know, you get the buzzer. And so what do? Well, in meditation, we just relax out of it. We recognize it's happening and we relax out of it. In daily life, we have to do subject object. I mean, you'll get run over by a car, you know, crossing the street. So we got to do that in daily life. But the thing is, we got to know that we're doing it. So sometimes we do it, but in meditation, we let it go. And we find ourselves in subject-object conceptuality, and we back off. And you do it again, and you back off. And Ken's going to lead us through that process. So back to Pema Chidren. Our experience is completely colored by our thinking mind, our conceptualizing, concretizing mind, mind that fixates and makes things solid, mind that sees itself as the subject and everything else as an object. A simple example is lying in bed in the morning and it's raining. You hear rain on the roof. Maybe you can sleep in and it's such a soothing, pleasant sound. It's a sound you like and you can doze in it and you can doze in and out listening to it. However, if you were planning a picnic or an outdoor wedding that day, the very same sound you label as unpleasant, unwanted, the very same sound you label it now as unpleasant, unwanted, you wish it weren't happening. But the rain remains the rain. The sound remains the same. I hope there will be questions about this because it is very provocative. There probably weren't. Everybody just got up and asked about how to deal with personal situations and all of her seminars. So she says, we are caught in a projected experience of life. Okay, let's think about that. We are caught in a projected experience of life, right? That's what it means when we're told that all our experiences are projections. You know, I went many years not really understanding what that meant. And I'm not saying that I fully understand it now, but that's it. As soon as the perception arises, it's already colored or influenced by our expectations of it, by our conceptuality about it that's already been developed. So we are caught in a projected experience of life. We're projecting our opinions and judgments and colorations onto every single thing that arises in our mind or in our experience. And our happiness and unhappiness depend much more on our state of mind and how we label things than we usually realize. If you could just hear rain as rain without the label and know it's just a label, then the nature of rain is not good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant. We can still have the thought, oh darn, I wish it weren't raining today, or oh good, I can just lie in bed and not do anything. But the important thing is to understand that it's not the rain that's bad or good. It's just raining. And that's what Ken is going to help us with, like in a meditation form. And then she told a story of a couple that was bicycling who heard that the sea was nearby, like somewhere over the, you know, they can't see it, but they hear the sea. Well, now they're in bed. They're lying in bed. So I don't know where the bicycle came in, but they heard the sea was nearby. I actually had this exact experience one time. I'll tell you about it. They lay there in bed and listened to the sound of the sea. So delightful. No, wait a minute. It sounds like traffic. Suddenly, the very same sound was unpleasant. This is news we can use in terms of our happiness and unhappiness. That happens. That is such an interesting and edifying moment when you catch yourself thinking something is one thing and you suddenly figure out it's something else. And I went to a medical conference back when I was a medical writer back in, you know, the 80s. And I was sent to Anaheim, California to a, you know, where Disneyland is, to a conference. And it was nighttime when I arrived and I looked out my window and I saw this beautiful lake outside. And I'm like, oh, wow, it's a beautiful lake. And then when I woke up the next morning, it turned out to be a parking lot. It was really different. And I wrote a postcard to Long about it. He thought it was very funny. Like, that's kind of the thing. So anyway, she says, it's not that you can suddenly switch to just sound. Like, you're going to have that. You can't just decide, okay, I'm not going to see anything through those colored lenses anymore. I'm now just going to see things the way they are. You can't suddenly do that, says Kind of Children. But you can realize that you're laying something on top of it and be okay with that. So again, you can still think, oh, darn, it's raining, but you go, oh, but, you know, that's me. That's me that makes it, oh, darn, it's raining, or, oh, wonderful, it's raining. And that, you know, I didn't want to go to, it's canceled. So she goes on to say, but mind itself, the actual nature or essence of mind, how do we see that? She's going to tell us one way to see that. If you have a gap, for a moment, your mind is thought-free, and we've all had that experience. What is that? Like the space between thoughts. She says, I refer to it as the highest level of freedom, as open sky, as that which you can relax and open into. And here the verse calls it mind itself, or nature of mind. So that's one thing that we can look for. And that's one of the first things that we're taught to look for in the Kagyu tradition of, you know, meditation instruction is look for the gap. Look for that moment when you're not having a thought and rest in that. Like whenever there's no thought, you can rest in that and you can like let that kind of expand a bit. And big secret is that there are times, I mean, this is like a fairly advanced meditation instruction, but I think it's something that we all are also aware of, is that there are times when our mind is naturally free of concept. And a couple of examples of that are when we sneeze. Like suddenly your mind is free of thought. You cannot be thinking a thought while you're sneezing. You can test that out for yourself and see if it seems to be true. But that's a natural gap. It's something like that. I know like when I have to sneeze when I'm driving, it's like a bit of a precarious moment. Like you have to really, you know, really exert some will to keep your mind and everything on the road. Another time is when something scares you. You know, like you get a shock or a scare. Somebody says boo and it really scares you. Your mind goes blank, completely blank. That's the kind of gap that we can also naturally have anytime between thoughts. Looking at a sunset sometimes or a fish tank, you get caught up in just like the actual bare awareness of the thing. And bare awareness is another synonym for the nature of mind. So anyway, I'll stop talking and finish up Pema Chodron so we can get to Ken and have time for it. She says, mind itself is free of any of these conceptual limitations, free of stories, free of labels, free of concretizing, free of subject-object fixation, which she defines as solid me, solid you. It's presenting another way we could live. Mind itself, like looking at mind itself, looking at the gap, is presenting another way we could live. Or even just recognizing the overlay that we're putting on something and knowing like that it's an overlay. And that may not allow you to get rid of it completely, but it allows you to connect with the underlying bare awareness. She says, it's presenting another way we could live. With our sense perceptions, we could experience sight, smell, sound, taste, touch, emotions. We could experience them free of conceptual limitations, free of labels. This is a powerful alternative. Let's think if we know anybody who can do that. We do. We know lots of people who can do that. Those are our teachers. They don't get carried away by concepts. There's this wonderful moment. I'm just going to digress for another second. I don't know, you've probably seen, some of you may have seen Kala Rinpoche's, there's a video of Kala Rinpoche teaching Mahamudra. I think it's called Nature of Mind. Used to have it on a videotape. And there's this wonderful moment. It was like Yeshe Jamso, a lot of us know Yeshe Jamso from KTC, now he's at KTD. He was the translator. He was a brand new translator. He had done his first retreat. Kala Rinpoche was here in 1986 to put people in the second retreat. And he was going to go in the second retreat. He was still a monk. But he'd had some, you know, he'd studied Tibetan a lot, and he'd been to India and really studied and become a translator. So he's kind of a new translator. And there's this moment as he's translating. He's a fabulous translator, like not a distractible person. And there's this moment when there's a crash. There's some kind of a loud noise, like off stage, out of the video. And he turns around like this. And Kala Rinpoche also turns around, but not toward the sound. He turns and looks at Yeshe Jamso. Yeshe Jamso doesn't see that. So why is he looking at Yeshe Jamso? I think it's because he's seeing Yeshe Jamso be distracted by a sound and being drawn to it as something outside himself, instead of having done his first retreat, sort of staying in equanimity and realizing that this sound is taking place in his own mind. That's my overlay on that. But it's a really lovely moment if you notice it. So anyway. So we do have this alternative way of relating to things, which is bare awareness, free of storylines and labels and so forth. For most people who start to practice this way, to experience life seeing and hearing and smelling things just as they are, without limiting them to being good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, usually you go in and out. It's not something you can sustain, but you can do it for a moment now and then. You see that you are labeling, and you don't criticize yourself. You're okay with it. You just see that it's just your view or opinion. It's a relative perception, not an absolute truth. And if we could keep that much in mind when we get into political arguments and family arguments and so on and so forth, it would be amazing. I mean, still have the conversation, and you might still get emotionally involved, but knowing that it's a construct and it's not reality is really helpful. And why is it helpful? We're going to talk next week. We're going to read from Kempo Sultram Jamsa Rinpoche, who points out that what this is about seeing our regular experience the same way that we see and relate to a dream. In a dream, we can have all the same appearances. But when we wake up, we know it was all in our mind. There was nothing actually there. So that's what this is about. You see it, you might still be caught up in it, but you see it's like a dream, like it's all in some sense within your own mind. So she finishes by saying, when we have an opinion about something, we generally take it to be an absolute truth, and we can all do this. It is like this, we think. Just think of your political position and somebody that you think of as not getting it. So we think, and she says, people who do this, who take their own opinion as absolute truth, people who do this are wrong. Nothing or nobody is intrinsically pleasant or unpleasant, right or wrong. We impute the meaning. So I'm going to stop there with permission. Anybody have any comments or questions before we do our meditation? Yes, Valerie, I'm unmuting you, and you are unmute.
I think this idea was in that movie, that Italian movie, where the family's going off to like Auschwitz, and he's trying to make it all funny for the little kid.
Oh yes,
I never saw that.
It's a Beautiful Life.
Yeah, but yeah. I think that's this to some degree.
No, I don't think it is. I think you could look at it that way, though. I mean, he knew. He knew it was really bad, and he was just trying to protect his child from
fear. Right, but if the kid...
Yeah, you're saying something else, so...
Well, he's trying to get the kid to see it as not a horror.
Right. I get what you're saying, you know, that he's putting another layer on for the kid. I mean, he's not stripping anything away here, but he is acknowledging that you could look at the same thing and see two different things.
Well, but also, you can look at that like it's a dream, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but unfortunately, you know, they were stuck in relative reality there. but I get your point. I get your point. And yes, we have that flexibility. And we can play with that, too. Take a smell that you, like, you're suddenly, like, confronted with a terrible smell. Can you see it as pleasant? You can, actually. It's really possible. Eating like the food you hate the most, because you have to for some reason, can you see it as something enjoyable or vice versa? I don't know. But, well, you know, they say that you've achieved equal taste, which is, you know, a very, very high state of realization, when you could eat ice cream and feces and just experience them in exactly the same way. So when we get there, I mean, that's how hard it is. That's how hard it is to do this. But we can get glimpses of it, and getting glimpses of the process is really, really valuable, and it leads us in the direction of being able eventually to actually see things that way, which I think many of our realized teachers are able to do. Anybody else? Yes, Joanne.
Therefore, are you describing, and I'm non-labeling, the view, is that non-dualistic approach to reality, as the same time that aspect of emptiness, am I bringing a lot into the picture? I'm trying to wrap my head around it and relate to it. So I'm like at the cusp of almost understanding, but not quite there. But again, is that where we're headed?
Yeah, if I understand what you're saying correctly, yes, non-dualistic perception and emptiness are the same thing. It just means there are no distinctions. There's nothing that you can say about it. There's no quality that's inherent to the thing or the experience. And that is emptiness. That is a description of emptiness, which is one of the qualities of the nature of mind. The other main quality being that we can be aware that that's true. There's emptiness and there's awareness, or there's emptiness and there's luminosity, which are pretty synonymous.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else have anything? All right, then we're going to do Ken MacLeod's meditation. So this is our main meditation today. And then hopefully we're going to briefly look at verse 1 again. All right, so let's put ourselves in meditation mode, insofar as there is a meditation mode. Ultimately, there is no meditation mode, and we're just meditating all the time. But right now, there is a meditation mode. So we'll just make our bodies comfortable and relaxed and alert. receptive. And we will take a moment to rest in open awareness or follow the breath, whatever you need to bring your mind to focus and let go of everything else. Actually, he's going to start us off that way. He says, take a breath. I forgot he starts out that way. Take a breath, let it out slowly without strain, and do that again three or more times. We'll just take three breaths, three relaxed breaths, letting our mind and body settle naturally. We'll all take three breaths and we'll see how many that is for everybody. And eyes can be closed or open. So now think of something. It can be anything, and I'm just reading Ken here, but think of just one thing, your partner, a friend, a flower, an idea. I mean, if you don't have an idea, it could be the Statue of Liberty. Think of the Statue of Liberty, just bring it to mind. He says the thought can be a word or phrase, a picture or a sound. So now we ask ourselves, where is that thought or that image? In your mind, of course, but what does that mean? Is this thought or image inside your head? Is it outside your head, the Statue of Liberty or whatever else you're seeing? And we're going to take pauses to look, to actually do this exercise. Is it inside your head? Is it outside your head? Whether it's a word or an image or a thought. It is there. It is vivid. Say you have a picture in your mind. Where is that picture? Is it inside? Is it outside? Where is it? If you have not done this exercise before, says Ken, by now you are probably flooded with thoughts and ideas and are trying to figure out how to do it. Like, where is it? Instead, let's let it all go and start again. And he's going to lead it through us in a different way. So let's do three more or however many slow, relaxed breaths. Following the breath, but letting our minds be very open and relaxed and inclusive. Letting go of all thoughts. Meaning that they can come and go, but we're not fixating on them. Now again, think a thought about just one thing. Picture it if you wish. So it could be the Statue of Liberty or your car or whatever. Where is that picture? When you look this time, do not look with your mind. Do not look with your eyes. Do not try to figure anything out. Just look. So your psyche is just in the mode of looking, which is it's a receptive thing. It's not an active thing. It's a stepping back and not generating ideas, but just being receptive, looking and being receptive. Just look with your whole being, including your body. Still looking at whatever that thought or image is that we have in our mind. You know, see, or hear the thought. The thought is there, definitely, but where is it? Do not try to figure this out. Just look. Where is it? You cannot say. Just rest there. You cannot say, so do not try to say what it is. Just rest there, resting and looking. All right, now we're going to do another exercise, so stay in the same mode. Now take a feeling, an emotion, anger, love, joy, grief, pride, compassion. Pick one, it doesn't matter which one, and bring that feeling to mind. What it feels like to be angry, or what it feels like to feel joy or love or grief. you can bring a situation to mind if you need to, but we can probably just bring an emotion. So bring the feeling to mind and ask, where is it? As for the physical sensations associated with those feelings, we will deal with those in a moment, but for now, just ask, where is the feeling? And look. What do you see? Again, this completely passive receptivity. You feel the anger, you feel the love, you feel the physical sensations, but where is the feeling? You say, in my mind, but where is that? You can feel the physical sensations, tension, contraction, and tightness with anger, warmth, relaxation, possibly a different kind of tension with love. Are the physical sensations the actual feeling? There is an emotional quality too. Where is that? Again, we're doing this in a non-conceptual way, just looking and resting. Where is the feeling? Not the physical feeling, but the emotional impact of anger or love or joy or grief. You cannot say. No one can. So if you didn't come up with an answer, that is the answer. No one can say where it is. Again, rest there, looking and resting. So still looking at that emotion. Looking at it, looking and asking yourself where it is, and knowing that there is no answer, there is no conceptual answer to that. Cannot say. And now a third exercise, staying in that meditation mode. Now look at an object, anything that you can see right now. It says a chair, a book, a vase, anything that you can see right now, your computer, a pair of scissors, whatever there is. You see the object, so you've picked an object. Now we're looking at the object. But where is the seeing taking place? Is your mind somehow going out to the object, or is the object somehow coming into your mind? Where are you actually seeing the object? Where does the act of seeing happen? You may think, in my head. What is the seeing in your head? If you look at an object that is larger than your head, let's pick one of those. Some object in your field of vision that's larger than your head. It is hard to see how the seeing could take place in your head. And if anybody, you should all know the story of Milarepa and the yak horn. I think this is the explanation for it. If you do not know the story of Milarepa and the yak horn, jot that down and Google it, because you now have the key to Milarepa and the yak horn. Because it's the same question. Where are we seeing the object? And what if it's an object that's bigger than our head? Where do we see it? And what does size even mean? So it takes place in my mind, you say. Exactly, says Ken. But where is that? So still looking at whatever object we want to look at. It takes place in my mind, yep. But where is that? And Ken says, you cannot say. And you are right back where you were with thoughts and feelings. They are there, but you cannot say where they are. You see, but you cannot say where the seeing is. And so I like this exercise because it's kind of easy to see that, easier to see that with more abstract things like emotions or a mental image, but an object outside us, it's like, one way that this has been said by Ari Goldfield when he taught at KTC the first time, one of the exercises he gave us was to look at an object and ask, where does the mind end and the object begin? Ken says, it is the same with the other senses, but the habituations, or the, you know, the, our habits, the way we habitually perceive them, with some of them are stronger. Try sound first, he says. Listen to a piece of music. We can't really do that. The ringing of a bell or the hum of your refrigerator. Let's do a gong. I brought one. And the question is, where is the hearing taking place? Does our mind go to the gong to hear it, or does the gong come to our mind to hear it? If we think it's taking place in our mind, where is that exactly? Not analyzing, just looking or hearing. And Ken has the same answer again. He cannot say. These are all trick questions because they haven't got an answer. And he says it is the same with physical sensations. You feel them. You associate them with very specific parts of your body, an itch on your back, the texture of your shirt, the tightness in your jaw when you are angry, the pain in a stiff muscle, a queasy feeling in your stomach. But where does the sensing take place? If we feel cold, where are we actually feeling and perceiving that? You cannot say, says Kim. And then he says, and we're still in the meditation, remember what Tokme Zangpo says. And this is his translation of that first line, whatever arises in experience is your own mind. For all appearances are my own mind. Everything I experience is my mind. He says, in other words, what you experience is your mind. It's not saying it's like my mind or it's in my mind. It is my mind. Your mind is not a thing. It is not located anywhere. So let's ask that question for a moment. This is your classic first, you know, first vipassana, because this is vipassana meditation. This is insight meditation. This is meditation that directs us to look at mind itself. And the way we usually do that at the beginning, before we bring things into it, as Ken has done, is we look at mind. We say, where is my mind? Is it inside my body? Is it outside my body? Is it both? Is it neither? Does it have a color? Does mind have a shape? Does it come from here? And those questions, we don't ponder those questions. We ask the question and then we let it go and we just look. And what we've done, it's not about the question. It's not about whether mind has a shape. That question shifts our focus to look at mind. And then we just rest in that looking. And we don't care if it has a shape or a color. And as Ken says, we can't say. We can never say. But the point of it is not that it doesn't have a shape or color so much as that it shifts our focus. And we are able, through that question, to actually get a sense of looking at mind, where we never find anything. So he says, your mind is not a thing. It is not located anywhere. Your mind is what you experience. And KDC people will recognize that Rinpoche Tulpa said something very similar. Your mind is what you experience. What you experience is your mind. And this is not something that you can conceptually understand. You have to feel your way into it by simply being receptive. So Ken says, wherever you are, as you read this or you hear this, look around, open to everything that you see, everything that you hear or touch, everything that you think or feel, all those experiences. And you can look around if you want to. All those experiences, the seeing, the hearing, the feeling, the thinking, all of that is your mind. It is a bit like a dream. Because, right, in a dream, it's all in your mind, right? Is it actually in your head? We can't say. But we know of a dream that no matter what happens in it, no matter what happens to us in it, we can be killed in it. But then we wake up and there could be people in it, like all kinds of people that we know and don't know. And we know that there are no people there. It's a non-dual experience. It is our own mind. Everything in a dream takes place in our own mind, and we know that. And we're being encouraged to look at all of our experience as being, in some sense, the same as that. So he says, rest there in that sense of openness, like everything that I'm seeing, hearing, feeling, etc. in this moment is my mind. It's not different from my mind. It is my mind. And it is my mind in the same way a dream is my mind. He says, rest there for a few moments, taking it all in. A little puzzled, perhaps a little in awe, because we didn't grasp something intellectual here. We don't know something. We're just resting in some kind of awareness. He says, it is a different way of experiencing life. So then he asks the question, and we're still meditating here, what experiences all of this? Who or what experiences all of this? Who's experiencing this? It's like a dream. You may recognize that as these are the steps of the ultimate bodhicitta meditation, 7 points of mind training. Who or what experiences all this? Again, do not try to figure it out, Ken says. Do not start thinking about the question. Just ask the question and look. Who experiences or what is experiencing what I'm experiencing right now? What mechanism is experiencing my experience? Just look. Look in the resting and rest in the looking. So we've just directed our attention to something that is by definition non-conceptual. There is no answer to it. We cannot say. Who or what experiences our experience? And you could intellectually remember at this moment that what we're talking about is non-duality. And therein lies our answer, which is not a conceptual answer, because concept is by definition dualistic. There is no non-dualistic concept. So we're directing our attention beyond conceptuality into that gap that Pema Chodron talked about. So he says, rest again, looking in the resting, resting in the looking, resting in that awareness. We'll take just a moment to do that. Letting go of all the questions, we're just resting in the awareness that we are left in. Not letting go of the looking exactly, but it's not an active thing. He says, thoughts and feelings may come and go, but, and he's going to give us an answer here, there is no observer, no watcher. And that's what Gampoka said too. They are there and then they are gone. There's a sense of an observer, but you can also have that sense of no observer. They are there and then they are gone, like snowflakes on a hot stone. That's a classic simile from the meditation instruction literature. It does not matter whether the thoughts are of I or some object. It does not matter whether they are explicit words or images or vague feelings and sensations. They are all movements in awareness, yet there is nothing there that moves. This is not something you think. This is something you experience. And he says, and this is comforting to all of us, most, and we're done with the meditation part now, so we can kind of come back, or you can stay in it. Most people are able to do this practice for only a moment or two before their attention destabilizes and they fall back into thinking, into the ordinary subject-object mode of experience. So it's not like we're supposed to read this verse and suddenly know how to do this thing. And then from now on, we can just drop the subject-object. We can't. But this verse helps us direct our attention to that non-dualistic place for a moment at a time. He says, if that happens to you, you get it and you lose it. Do not try to hold on to shifts or insights. When attention crumbles, it crumbles. It is gone. Start again at the beginning, letting mind and body settle, following the breath, and then you could start asking those questions and just rest in that awareness. Work at this patiently, quietly building capacity rather than trying to understand something. Don't do that. Or trying to make something happen. Don't do that. There's no more correct experience than what you're experiencing whenever you look. And don't try to hold on to something that did happen. Like you feel like you got it for a minute. When it starts to crumble, it crumbles. Just go back to breathing and go back to looking. He says, in time, you are able to rest for longer periods without your attention going to pieces. You can look more deeply and see more clearly. Only if you do it repeatedly. That's the only way that happens. You only get more capacity if you do this regularly, routinely, say on a daily basis. Otherwise, it remains a random experience or a momentary experience. He says, when you are able to rest in clear, empty awareness, you can start learning how to live there. Begin with simple movements. So he's saying now we could get off the cushion and bring this into our daily life, because this is cushion stuff right here. Because what we have to do is our meditation discipline in order to actually, you know, be able to experience this without being on the cushion. So as we take it off the cushion, he says, begin with simple movements and try to ask the question and look and rest in that awareness while you're moving. It's actually a very big transition there. You could do like Zen walking or something. You know, slow walking, that is what Zen walking is about. Then you could take it to simple repetitive tasks, do it while you're washing the dishes or whatever. Then gradually include more sensations and work up to moving through your day in that kind of awareness. There will be lapses, of course, but that is why it is called practice. And that's the end of Ken's commentary. So I thought that was just lovely. That is a very advanced and deep meditation, but it's also a simple meditation. Like, it's not like anybody could not do it. It's not too hard for anybody, but it's only really effective if you've built up a base of shinai that you can sort of sustain your attention in a relaxed but alert way on like where you want to put your attention for a little while. Then you can go through this process, because if you have not tamed the wild flow of distraction into chains of thought, at least a little bit, then you can't really do this. You still have to depend on random, you know, those random gaps and sort of recognizing one of those. But what he's saying is that you can cultivate this. And that's what the verse is about. So the verse again, all appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free, meaning mind itself is completely non-conceptual. And that's what we're looking at in this kind of meditation. He says, to know exactly this, this precise thing, to know this, mind is non-conceptual and everything we experience is mind. And therefore not to engage in grasping signs of subject and object. This is the way Bodhisattva trains. So this is a fairly literal translation. Some of the other translations did not include the word signs, which is in the Tibetan and has a very specific meaning, and I'm no expert on it, so I'm not even going to try. Well, the way I take it, though, on my ordinary understanding is, like, to notice, and again, this is on the cushion. Verse 22 is on the cushion, on the chair. So we look at our experience, like whatever we're experiencing as we're sitting in our meditation, and we catch ourselves subjectifying and objectifying, like grasping onto, like, we start to sense something as being an object that we are looking at, and we let it go. That's all you can do. You can ask the question, like you could say, where does my mind end and that thing start, or that other person or that thought start? And it always brings you back to, I can't say, and that dissolves. And then the next thing comes along that is a concept, a subject and an object. You have an observer that's observing something, and you just let it soften. You don't banish the observer, you can't do it. But you just, when you catch it, then you can sort of let it soften up a bit. The edges become more fuzzy, let's say, not a great word, but things kind of can sort of meld together a little bit. But then they're always going to come back as subject-object, because how many trillions of lifetimes of training do we have in that? Like, that is the skandhas. We're working with the skandhas here. So anyway, study this verse for the next week. Like, read this verse at least once every day. Meditate with it. Meditate. If you have Ken's commentary, meditate with that. If you don't, it's fine. I'm trying to think where else it might be. There are some things in Ringu Tulku, some exercises there. But just do that. Like, just whatever's coming up in your experience, ask, where is that? Where is that one who's seeing that? and you just rest in looking, and you let go of analysis, you let go of conceptuality, and it takes you there. You don't have to have Ken Hall in your hand. But if it's helpful, I could send an email with like one of the exercises in it. Is that helpful to people? Like if you don't have the book? Okay. I see some heads nodding, so I'll email one of Ken's meditations. Okay, I'll just do a very pared down version of it. All right, so we're just about out of time. I don't think we're going to do Akshobhya together, but I do want to think about verse 1 for a minute, and I hope that everybody had a chance to revisit it. Verse 1 is, this precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. I see people chanting along. So we don't want to lose sight. We never want to lose sight of the preliminaries, of any of the understanding that we've built up about the path and how to travel it. So this week we're looking, and next week we'll look at the second one, to leave my homeland. But just for this moment, remember the precious human existence. Like that's the first of the four thoughts as well. And remember what makes it a precious human existence. It's got the 8 freedoms and it's got the 10 resources. If you don't remember what those are, then go back and look at the Torch of Certainty or Gampopa. He has a chapter on precious human existence. Look at something, refresh your memory of what makes it precious. And especially the Torch of Certainty also gives us like the 16 ways we can screw up and not make use of it. And we won't get it again. It says that the problem with not using it is we've wasted it and we won't have any impetus to get it again next time. We could be an earthworm. Probably not. Sita Rinpoche says, don't panic. Like if you improve a little bit, if you use it a little bit in this lifetime, then you're probably good. Because as Westerners, we think we have to be perfect. So it's not like that, but we do want to keep it in mind and not waste too much of our time. And what does that mean? It means to study, contemplate, and meditate. And we talked about that, remember, that you can do it for 24 hours a day. You know, maybe it's harder when we're sleeping. So you prepare yourself. As you go to sleep, you could do some taking and sending. You could visualize the Lama or the Buddha in your heart, sending light, like whatever Dharma thing you can do as you go to sleep sets you up for sleep possibly to be a use of your precious human existence. But our waking hours, we can remember the Dharma all the time and we can do our best to act in Dharmic ways. We can know the 10 unvirtuous actions and avoid them. And we can study our 37 practices. We can contemplate. And most of all, we can meditate. We must meditate if we really want to travel the path. So to study, contemplate, and meditate without distraction day and night. So without distraction means we really have the intention. We really set the intention not to go off into like thought chains, not to get distracted from what we're doing. To really, for example, rest in open awareness as much of the day as we can. Or follow our breath if that's all we can do to sort of bring ourselves back to the present moment. Always try to be in the present moment. And it's not like an ironclad rule and you're going to be punished if you don't. It's like whenever you notice you're not in the present moment, use the breath or use open awareness or use the 37 practices to bring yourself back to the present moment. And you might go away right away. You might only have it for a second, but the more you do that, the more it builds up the momentum to stay there. So don't forget verse 1. And why do we do it? Like, why is it important? Because it is the only way to set ourselves free and others free. To navigate samsara's endless sea, because we'll be stuck in samsara forever. If you read my post on verse 22, I bring in Gampopa's introduction where he says, samsara is endless. It won't stop if we don't stop it. It's not going to stop by itself. So by remembering our precious human existence and studying, contemplating, and meditating on the Dharma as much as we can, we navigate samsara's endless sea, meaning we could get to the end of it, to the other shore. And we do that to set ourselves and other beings free. And there's no other way. There may be other paths, other spiritual paths, other ways to formulate it. But this is the way to actually accomplish it. So anybody have anything before we do the dedication? All right, so for next week, don't forget the verses. Look at verse 2. I will send out an email. Look at verse 2, review verse 2, and continue to study verse 22. Oh, we have a lot of twos. And read and reread Dingo Chense's commentary and do the meditation. Do this kind of meditation where you sit and you actually, it could be as simple as looking, where is the mind? Does the mind have a shape? That's all you really need. That's Vipassana meditation. But you can ask any of the questions. And again, I'll send out something that will give you a few if you aren't really used to this kind of meditation.
Lama?
Yes, Joanne.
Okay.
Good initiative there.
All right. Verse 1, page 36 in Ken McLeod's book.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions a gap in the web of life that is never explored. Is that, you mentioned gap while we were meditating. Is that what he's alluding to?
I'm not sure. I don't have the, think I can take the time to look it up. It's on my Kindle, so it wouldn't be the same.
Sorry.
But we can ponder that. I'll take a look at that.
Thank you.
We can ponder that. But yes, we're always looking for the gap. I mean, really what we never explore is our own mind. And that's what we need. And that, and it's through the gaps in our conceptuality that we're there. And we just need to recognize it and be there. And that's how we explore it.
Thank you.
But I will look at that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I must go. Thank you so much. Bye, everyone. That was Beatrice. Bye, Beatrice. So glad you could be with us.
Thank you, Lama.
All right, so those of us who can stay will do the dedication. I'll pull up the right sheet. And I'll let's see, people are muted. All right, I think everybody's muted. I think everybody's muted. Or not. Okay. All right, dedicating all the merit from this study and practice together to the enlightenment of all beings, we must set ourselves and all other beings free. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, from Tu Zangpo and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And bringing our minds to rest for a moment, always remembering that the Lama, also known as the Buddha, we can see whatever form we wish, just enlightened mind, is always present. And we can think of it as being in our heart center and radiating all the time. And now I'm going to unmute everybody. We're a little bit over time. Sorry about that today. Okay.